In our time in prayer, would you pray with me? Gracious God, we are grateful for the lives of great men and women who have lived as pilgrims following Jesus Christ before us. And we are grateful tonight to have the life of St. Augustine, a life not by no means perfectly lived, but a life finally well lived in devotion to you. And we pray that what we learn, and there is so much, might not just fill our heads with more facts, but in some way might inspire our hearts to be devoted to the same Lord that radically transformed this man's life, Jesus Christ. And so it's to his glory that we commit what we do tonight. And in your name we pray. Amen. So we are going to look all to, I was talking briefly just now with someone who said, oh, I had an 8-week course in a church on the life of Augustine. 45 minutes, folks. So all too briefly, the life, works, and significance of Augustine. And he is arguably the most influential Christian writer outside of the Bible. Certainly in the part of the world we call the West, and for most of us, that means the part that we're familiar with, that has its roots in Europe and in this country. And he influences the Western tradition in such a deep way that all of us who find ourselves as Americans with any type of European ancestry or any type of relationship to the civilization as we know it, whether we're Christian or not, and I assume that tonight, of course, we're in a Christian context, but whether people are Christian or not, everyone has learned in some way to think about themselves, the world, God, from Augustine. Many of the concepts that we use when we think about who we are have their roots in Augustine's thought. For instance, if you think about your relationship between God and the self as a deep inner presence of God, well, you owe that eventually to Augustine. And if you didn't read it in Augustine, you read it in someone who read Augustine. It turns out that the existentialist philosophers draw deeply on Augustine. And it's unimaginable, really, apart from him. The whole notion of the biography, time, all kinds of things that we take for granted come from him. Alienation, that there is a conflict within us, that's Augustine, when he talks about the soul being far from the God who is properly, deeply within us. So, without further ado, I want to get into some biographical information and background about who he is, because that's very important for how he comes to understand Christian faith, and then we'll get into some of the specific big ideas, and I'm sure that this is going to be one of those, I wonder how far up on the beach we can get on this boat, because we will run out of water, as it were, as we head towards the end. Augustine's father was a pagan. He did not believe in God. He was a government official. He believed in other things than God. His mother was a very ambitious woman. Actually, we don't really need this picture yet. Like many parents in the biographies of great people, one or more of them was very ambitious, and Augustine had an ambitious mother, Monica. Eventually, she became a very devout Christian, and she would come to have a profound influence on his life. His parents were justifiably but intensely proud of him, and they wanted him to have a top-quality education, but as a government worker, they didn't have lots and lots of money, and so they weren't as wealthy as some of those who could afford it. They lived in... the pictures of Augustine are interesting. He is a North African. A lot of people try to, when they are sort of reading a litany of sins against Christian theology and Christian thought, they talk about all the dead white European males that are at the root of it all. And chief among them is Augustine. He's a North African. He's not a European. Now, his thought goes on to shape him, but so most of the pictures that we have of Augustine make him look like he is from way north of the Mediterranean, including this one, but that's not really who he was. Here is his world, and you can see that he is from, you can see where he is from, Tagaste in North Africa, which is near the border today between Algeria and Tunisia in modern-day Algeria. At the time that he lived in the 400s, North Africa was part of the Roman Empire. And the language of commerce and culture and increasingly of education was Latin. Tagaste was a military outpost. There were Roman legions stationed there to protect the empire from raiding desert nomads. The same ones, in some ways, that are still descendants, have descendants in this region. But the legions were the, in some ways, were the greatest threat to peace as well. That's a whole other story. This part of the empire was a kind of a Bible Belt. There was a rigid fundamentalist Christianity in North Africa that is rooted in some of the controversies that Augustine eventually would have to deal with, one of them called Donatism. More about that later. But there were people there who thought that they were going to be the only ones in heaven when they got there. And maybe you have had some experience or familiarity with folks like this. And so here is Augustine in this background, pagan father, eventually devout Christian mother. Augustine received a classical education in rhetoric. He was skilled in public speaking and in writing. In the ancient world, aspiring politicians studied rhetoric to trick people with words and to talk out of all sides of their mouth at once. I'm just telling you the way that they did it back then. Augustine later realized that rhetoric was used to manipulate people in this dishonest way, and he had a crisis there, but we won't get into it now. He had lots of crises in his life when he came to Christian faith. If you were really ambitious, you got out of Northern Africa and you went to Rome or to Milan. Those were the two centers of culture and education, and eventually Augustine would end up going to both places. This was his dream. And before him, this was his parents' dream, and in particular, this was his mother's dream. So Augustine, although he was a North African, did everything that he could in his education and his culture shaping to make himself more Roman than the Romans were and to get at the heart of what Roman culture was about. Excuse me. We know of his early life only from his autobiography in the Confessions. If you're familiar with the Confessions, which were written after Augustine had become a bishop, and after he had, of course, then become a Christian, you will recall that if you can get past the language or if you can find the right translation, it's kind of racy. Augustine paints himself as quite worldly. Well, he was in school in Tagaste and also in Madara, and the money ran out, and also his boredom got the better of him for a year. And so he sort of wandered. So for those of us who have had those periods where we've just sort of wandered, or if we have children or grandchildren who are in a point where they're kind of wandering, well, they're in good company, and Augustine had to do that as well. Eventually, he found his way to Carthage, which you can see is on the coast. there in that little point that's pretty close to Italy, actually. And there he was going to continue to go to school. While he was there, he took a common law wife. And so basically he was living with a woman. And building on this year of idleness, the influence of Carthage, it was a bigger city, there was more to do, there was more trouble to get into. And he fell in love, and whether or not he fell in love with this woman or fell in love with the idea of love, it's hard to tell. But he did begin to get lots of worldly experience. He had a son named, which they called Adeodatus, which means gift of God. Interesting, he's not a Christian yet, so perhaps he wasn't as wayward as it appears. While he is in Carthage, he read Cicero. And Cicero is the great classical, Latin classical writer. And the work that he read is the Hortensius, which we really don't have anymore. We've lost it, except for a few fragments. But when Augustine took his rhetoric class, Cicero was the one that they read. The Hortensius, though, was an exhortation about being a philosopher. And Cicero's ideas impressed on Augustine that wisdom alone would bring the only ultimate, true, and full happiness. And he was kind of looking for love in so many places. And where would he find it? And Cicero said, you'll find it in the search for wisdom. So Augustine tells us that his heart came on fire to attain the wisdom that Cicero talked about. And it fueled in him a longing for wisdom, whatever that might be. He longed to find what he called true happiness, what we might describe, certainly what C.S. Lewis eventually described as joy. When Earl was talking about C.S. Lewis last week, I was thinking about this week, and I am convinced, and so are several of several Lewis scholars I know, that Lewis was thoroughly influenced by Augustine. Although I can't think of any particular piece that Lewis wrote specifically on Augustine. But when Lewis talks about being surprised by joy, I think that in some ways he was not on an altogether different journey than Augustine found himself on. Later on, when Augustine would reflect back on this period of life, he would write that the only thing missing from Cicero's vision of the life of wisdom and contemplation was the name of Christ. And so, like many in the early history of the intellectual life of the church, there was this bringing together of classical philosophical learning and Christian faith. Soon after reading Cicero, on this search, Augustine turned to the Christian scriptures and he started reading them, but he couldn't get around whatever it was from his past, and perhaps it was the way that the Christian faith was expressed and lived where he grew up, but he rejected them because he felt that their words were just not profound enough, and they were just, later on he would say they were too humble for him, and that was his problem. But basically he was a intelligent, know-it-all, snot-nosed university student. And, someone says we know some people like that, yes. So he dismissed that. He's still on his search for wisdom. Where will he find it? But he didn't want to become one of those Bible-thumping people like he knew back home. Eventually, he found the teaching of a philosopher by the name of Mani to be helpful to him. And the followers of Mani were called Manichees, and the religion is called Manichaeism, or sometimes Manichaeanism. The Manichaeans knew very well the name of Christ. They used it all the time. But they were rationalists, and they did not need to take anyone else's word for anything. They could figure it out on their own. They didn't need to obey the authority of the church. They could prove their truth. They fancied themselves as scientific, and this appealed, at least in the early stages, to Augustine's developing intellect. In addition to being rationalists, the Manichaeans were materialists. They believed that everything, even God, was made of some kind of matter. God was light in the heavens, for instance. And they, for all they could determine, they didn't have the benefit of our modern physics, and so they didn't know about wave theory or of light or anything like that, and they just saw it as a kind of matter, but of course different than the kind of matter that you and I are made of, or that the trees were. But more importantly than anything, the Manichaeans were dualists, and a dualist is just a way of saying that two of something. Monists believe are sort of as opposed to dualists. A monist holds to one of something, and so Christians and Jews are monotheists because we believe in one God. And in the West, we hold to monogamy, that there should be one husband, one wife. And if someone is not varying their pitch very much at all, we call that monotone. Dualism, of course, from duo, from which we get a duet. The Manichaeans held to a dualistic cosmology, a dualistic way of understanding the way that all reality worked. And for them, there were two forces that governed the universe: the power of light and the power of darkness. And these two are engaged in a cosmic battle. And if you've ever seen Star Wars, you get a kind of a picture, because in a dualistic understanding, you're not sure if the dark side or if the light side is going to prevail. Now, I find it interesting in Star Wars that somehow the light side does prevail, and that's what we're all hoping for, and that's what all the good people are. But besides that, that's the kind of picture where there's good and there's evil, and they are locked into some type of cosmic struggle, and that our lives are lived out in the midst of these cosmic forces doing battle. And we're sort of there, not really as part of it, but it affects what happens to us and who we are and how we experience things. And to some extent, we in our lives experience this cosmic struggle between good and evil. And it might not be consciously, and we might not see it going on, and especially if we're not Jedi Knights or Luke Skywalker or are somehow tuned into it. But in the way that we live our daily lives, we have decisions to be made, and we can choose good or we can choose evil. And sometimes, and Augustine particularly found this, he knew what was good and he chose evil. And he did not really know what to do with that, and he couldn't explain it. Well, the Manichaeans helped him to do that. And they basically sorted it out that in this world of dualism, where there's good and there's evil, that which was evil had matter to it, and particularly the kind of matter that our bodies are made of. And that which is good was light, and that each of us as human beings with our bodies had the capacity to have a spark of light in us, and that was the soul. Now, the Manichaeans in particular thought that not everybody had one of these sparks of light. In fact, only really special people had sparks of light. So for the most part, most of the people, the common masses, the hoi polloi, didn't have a spark of light, and they were basically just like so many other species of animals, and they could not rise above their ability, and they were basically unrefined and hopeless. And really, they didn't have any hope in the world. But there were those who had the spark of light, and the key to successful life and to happiness was, as much as possible, to shed off the material evil, wicked stuff of matter in our body and rising above. And we see this pattern of spirituality repeated in lots of different religions and also in forms of Christianity, although they didn't, the forms of Christianity that held to this, particularly Neoplatonism or Platonism, did not hold that only a few people had the spark of light. They believed that everyone did. But nonetheless, we have this idea that what we have to do is do something to sort of torture our body so that it will let go of the light that's the spark of our soul, and that light can ascend up to God. Well, anyway, this was the worldview that Augustine lived in, and explained to him why he did so many things that his mother didn't approve of. And that really, it also helped to explain to him the struggle that he had. And it sort of let him off the hook. Because if we're in the middle of this cosmic struggle and there's both good and evil, and you don't know how it's going to end up, and, well, we're just sort of a victim. And maybe the devil made me do it. If you can remember that from Flip Wilson and Laffin. But that's the idea, that it's this struggle between good and evil, and I'm just a pawn here, and the devil made me do it, or evil made me do it. Or it's this wicked heart, you know, flesh that's weighing down the spark. And the older that I get, the more I kind of appreciate a little bit this idea that the flesh is just making it harder and harder to get on. And sometimes we feel like when we get sick, or when we get an allergy, or when we slam our finger in the door, or we stub our toe, we just think, oh, this stupid body, it's just getting in the way, and we're trying to think great thoughts, and maybe we're going to go home and read a really good book, and it just hurts too much, or I can't think, and stupid body. So this made sense to Augustine for a while. And he spent 9 years with the Manichaeans in what they call an auditor, which basically means he listened to them. It's like auditing the class, but he didn't take it for credit. He was not in one of their first circles of disciples, and he never became an actual Manichae, but it was like being a novice, I suppose, in a monastery or something. And he hung out with them, and he followed them closely. And he really liked this excuse for remaining in his sinful behaviors. It's always convenient when you can justify living in sin while you're aspiring to a vision of wisdom. And that's so conveniently, that's how where he was. So for 9 years, he was in this. And eventually, though, he would move out of it. And it might have been that he chose Manichaeism simply because he'd never really met any smart Christians. Well, while he was in the city of Carthage, and I'm not sure about all the details, and I'm not sure we even know what they all are, but he won a poetry contest. And because he's working on rhetoric and he's working on how words work, and he writes this poem and he wins the contest. And the Roman official who was watching the proceedings and who saw who the winner was and just kind of got a glimpse of his potential, he was so impressed with Augustine's ability that he gave Augustine an invitation to go to Rome to study. And so Augustine went to Rome, and that's where things really changed. He was really kind of tired and maybe a little bit fed up with, by now, what he considered the backwater attitudes of Carthage. He thought Carthage was great, leaving Thagas behind, but now he could go to Rome. And so he jumped at the chance to head off to the city where his great philosophical hero, Cicero, was from. And he wasn't in Rome for very long before he was noticed by a prefect named Symmachus. And Symmachus saw the talent, and even though Augustine was a foreigner, Symmachus made it possible for Augustine to become professor of rhetoric in Milan. And so he went from Rome to Milan, and while he was in Milan, he came providentially under the influence of the great Bishop Ambrose. Augustine was so impressed by this man's preaching. He had incredible rhetorical skill. He had a brilliant mind. How many of us have heard someone preach the gospel in such a compelling way that we just sort of were stopped, and it made all the difference in the world? I think some of you are familiar with this experience. I know it's happened to me. And as he began to listen to Ambrose preach and exposit the scriptures, the thought of the Manichaeans began to wear thin. And eventually, he would come to the point where he would turn to Christian faith. And in order to kind of get to where I want to get, I just want to jump ahead to that point. After a few years in Milan, under Ambrose's tutelage, I mean, he went through a whole process of refuting Manichaeanism, and he's written about this after the fact in his anti-Manichaean writings. So we know what he didn't like about them. Unfortunately, when I do the 8-week course, we'll do that. We've got 15 more minutes. It was Ambrose's teaching, but also a growing influence of Platonist, Neoplatonist philosophy, because they understood God as not being made of some kind of matter. But they understood God as being immaterial, and therefore as being one. And there was a monism rather than a dualism. And so this undermined the whole basis for the understanding of Manichaeism. And all of Augustine's longings that he had been living with and accruing over these years came together and were made clear in an experience in a garden of a friend's home in Milan. And this is probably the most famous episode out of Augustine's life. It's narrated in the Confessions, and if you know anything about Augustine, you know about this. He tells us that his eyes immediately fell upon one particular place when he had opened the Bible. It's one of those, you don't know what to do, you're lost, you have this Bible, you haven't looked, you know, at it for maybe ever, or can't remember the last time, you don't know what to do, you pull it off the shelf, you're desperate, you blow off the dust, and you just kind of open it up and you point, you know, and you hope you don't point at Judas went out and hung himself. And that didn't happen with Augustine. By the way, I don't know that that's a really good idea, to just kind of wherever you might point. But in God's providence, this is where it ended up with Augustine. He wrote about chapter 13 and 14 from Romans 13 in the Confessions, but it's pretty clear that he read the first two verses as well. Besides this, you know what time it is, how it is now the moment for you to wake from your sleep. For salvation is nearer to us now than when we became believers. The night is far gone, the day is near. Let us then lay aside the works of darkness and put on the armor of life. Augustine had lived, his whole life was the works of darkness as he sought the light, and this was profound. And these are the two verses that he actually quotes in the Confessions. Let us live honorably as in the day, not reveling in drunkenness. He knew that. Not in debauchery and licentiousness. He knew that. Not in quarreling and jealousy. He knew that. Instead, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. He knew that was his call, that was his salvation. This whole passage, the quoted and the unquote, quoted, struck him so powerfully. It was to him nothing less than this very much providential, at this particular moment in time, God's answer for him, point by point, to all of the tormenting issues and all of the stuff that he had been dealing with for all those years. He'd already kind of made this intellectual return to Christian faith as he had come to grips with the idea and the reality of there being one God. What troubled him now, though, was his morality, his moral impotence. And he found, because he found that he was able to will and to accomplish things by willing, all sorts of bodily actions, but at the same time he was incapable of mastering the spiritual impulses within himself. The will could command all of the powers except for the will itself. His will couldn't control his will. And he found himself helpless to make the kind of decision that he needed to make. He could not will totally without reservation. He could not embrace the kind of life that he'd come to feel himself most deeply longing to adopt. The pursuit of happiness and wisdom was nothing less than a life of uncompromising service to Christ. And that was the one thing he couldn't do. His inner conflict highlights three critical elements in the Christian life, which he then would come to write profoundly about: human freedom, the bondage of sinful habit, and our need for divine assistance or grace. His weaker half, he tells us in the Confessions, kept murmuring, later, do it later, just a little while, do it tomorrow, don't do it now, as if he was laying in bed, lazily putting off the moment for getting up. At the same time, he says, his better half screamed insistently, now, why not now, not tomorrow, not in a little while, but right this instant. Paul's text settled the dispute. It said, now is the hour to rise from sleep. Now? But that's impossible. Augustine had tried. He had tried to will. He had tried to make the leap into a new life, but he simply didn't have the strength to do it. He could clench his fist, he could move his limbs, but to achieve what he most deeply desired, that, ironically, still remained stubbornly beyond his reach. But Paul's text reassured him, your salvation is nearer than when you first believed. Point by point, every element in this text from Romans spoke to one or another facet of Augustine's experience of moral impotence. Let God be your strength, it suggested. Cast your cares on God. Let God take you up as a mother would her child, carry you where you long to go. Let God be the one who strips off your worldly trappings and garbs you in the armor of Christ's army. Having come to the end of St. Paul's passage, Augustine tells us this: I neither wished nor needed to read further. At once, with the last words of this sentence, it was as if a light of relief from all anxiety flooded into my heart. All the shadows of doubt were dispelled. So here are the major themes of Augustine's thought. They would emerge and develop from the way he came to understand faith in this particular place and moment. His life experience came to a climax in his conversion in the garden. So he is convinced that his experience was not unique to him, but is really typical of all of us. Further, he believed that all human conversions are, in fact, reversions. Literally, that is, a return to a blissful union with God that one time all of us enjoyed and had, at whatever point in our life, sinfully turned away from. Augustine,
He's a rhetor. He loves words. He loves to play with words. What he does with Latin, if you know Latin, is just elegant and beautiful. If you don't, or if you know it a little, it's hard. But he, this word turn, verteri, did I say it right, David? Close enough, vertera. He works with this and he turns the changes on it. Because we have averted ourselves from you, we have become perverted. Now let us revert, O Lord, so as not to be subverted. But there's a seriousness to all of this wordplay. Because Augustine wants to impress us and himself, but his readers, because he wrote it not just for himself, with the belief that we've all, like him, turned away from God. And he believes this idea is expressed in the biblical account of creation, where sinful humanity's relationship to God is symbolized by Adam's aversio, or turning away from his creator. And in this view, we've become both perverted and inverted, topsy-turvy creatures, facing and moving with all the elegance of the creatures of God in whose image we were created the wrong way. And so Augustine tells us that all of us need to be turned about and turned back and converted by God's gracious help in order to revert to our original condition of this blissful, peaceful union with God. And insofar as this makes sense to you and is a familiar idea to you, it's because of Augustine's influence on the way that we have been shaped and formed. And for those of you who care about the philosophical tradition, there's plenty of Plato's thought in there as well. So he's baptized by Ambrose, and then he starts writing. Eventually, he becomes a priest and then a bishop in North Africa, and he begins to deal with the controversies that will shape his writing, and from which I'm now going to make the five concluding remarks, summary remarks about his teaching. Actually, I'm in the middle of the outline, but we're near the end of the time. That makes them concluding, huh? And Augustine's thought. Faith. Faith makes it possible to understand. Faith is a gift from God. We can't do it without God. Augustine tried. He couldn't do it without God. Faith is God's gift to us. Whatever it is that we bring to our relationship to God, it begins with some kind of gift from God to us. It's not like we're out there on a dock with a boat that says whose motor is running with a sign that says leaving at 8 o'clock and we decide whether to get on the boat or not to get on the boat. That is not the decision that we make with Christian faith. We need God's help to get us and to move us into that relationship. So faith makes it possible to understand. We can't see God because our mind's eye is weak, it's sick, it's impure, it's inverted or averted. Faith enables us to see with the mind's eye, to understand. All of this, where did it come from? Augustine goes back to, it's Adam, it's original sin, and every human being suffers from it. And so we are hopeless without God's grace. We simply are not able to find our own way to God. Love and sin. Our love is intended to be for the eternal. It's intended to be for God alone. Sin is not doing bad things, really. We end up doing bad things because we sin. Sin is loving the wrong things in the wrong way. This world and all of the good things in this world and all the things that we might find ourselves desiring, this is all part of God's economy. The problem is that we end up wanting the wrong thing.
All of the creation is designed so that we can enjoy God, and in enjoying God, enjoy all of it. But typically, we want to enjoy all of these other things, and then if there's any place for God in there, to kind of figure that out. And we end up looking for love in all the wrong places. Because there's only one place to look for love, and that is God. And when we look everywhere else, we only get distracted, and then we end up not wanting God at all. And it's not because desire is bad. It's not because the things aren't good. It's because we get the priorities mixed up, and we make God penultimate rather than ultimate. Or, and maybe we get to the point where we are so lost that we don't even think we want God at all. And so we look for love everywhere else, and perhaps desperately. And Augustine talked about that God-shaped hole that we try to fill. And we'll try to fill it with everything. And only God will meet our need. Grace, undeserved favor. God stoops down to help us by giving us the Holy Spirit to strengthen our wills and to enable us both to believe and to obey God's commands. God doesn't do any of this. God doesn't reorient us. God doesn't give us faith because we're good enough. God does it just because that's who God is and that's what God does. And it out of God's great love for us. And there's nothing we can do to earn it. Absolutely nothing. We can't mess it up either. God is going to give it to us regardless of who we are. We have some ability to respond. So these three came to a head for Augustine in the Garden of Milan. There's two other important ideas for Augustine that are worked out elsewhere. One is evil. And he came to his understanding of evil when he refuted the Manichees. And the other is free will and predestination. And he came to that his conclusions there in refuting the Pelagians. Let's move on. I'll say a little bit about it. For evil, it wasn't because there are two competing powers in the universe. There is only one reality. There is only one true thing, and it's good. It's God. Evil is somehow a privation or a deprivation of some aspect of the good. So there is no such thing for Augustine as pure evil. And this is the way that much of Western civilization looks at evil. Privation is simply a way of talking about something being taken away. What has been taken away from you? Well, it's been deprived. If you have a good thing and you take the goodness or a part of the goodness away from it, then it's deprived. So, Satan is the most beautiful angel that there is in the heavens. There is none more beautiful, there is none more better than Satan. Unfortunately, Satan has an attitude problem. Satan lacks the attitude to love and serve God as the Creator. And so all of the goodness and the majesty and the beauty with which this angel, as we understand it in the history of the tradition, was created, gets turned sideways and wrong ways and ends up being the most evil that there is. Think of someone who is evil in human history. Hitler, right? Or someone else that you think of. But is that person flat out evil? I love Star Wars. So even Darth Vader, we discover, was created good and is intended to live a life for good. And when you follow the mythology of Star Wars all the way through, there is the possibility of redemption. And in fact, he is redeemed. The absence of something that there ought to be there leads to the experience of evil. And so Augustine is arguing that there could not be pure evil, because if there was nothing good, then there would be nothing left at all. Pure evil would simply be non-being. But what we experience as evil can only exist. It's like a parasite. Okay?
and evil needs something good on which to feed. And so when we find that evil is being done, or when we find ourselves doing evil, it's because there was some good that we intended. When we find ourselves sinning, there was some, you know, nobody sets out to do things that are bad. We do things that will make us, anybody here ever sin? What were you? Did you set out to sin? You say, I'm going to do something really bad. I'm going to do something that God will hate. No, you set out to do something you thought would make yourself happy, but somehow it got turned sideways, and so for him, that's what evil is. Free will and predestination. The ultimate irony is that when he was pushed on his understanding of the doctrine of grace, and pushed and pushed and pushed, not by Pelagius, but by later Pelagian teachers, and particularly Julian of Aquinum, they pushed him so hard that he said, it has nothing to do with us, nothing to do with us, nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with God, everything to do with God, everything to do with God. So much so that he ended up with this view that God does everything and that he does it before the foundation of the world. And he looked at Paul's passages in Romans and Ephesians, and that somehow God ends up making the decision on who will be saved and who will not be saved beforehand. And then this leaves a problem that we continue to try to come to grips with. And it is one of the ultimate ironies that it's the doctrine of grace that Augustine was preserving that he got pushed on, because the Pelagians were basically saying grace is we've all got the ability to do it, and you know, how many people have sinned? Are you going to sin again? Do you think you'll ever sin again? Well, why? Do you think the sin that you'll commit will be something that is brand new, that no one's ever done before? You can figure it out. You have the knowledge. If you really wanted to, you wouldn't sin. That was what Pelagius said. And so he got pushed and pushed and pushed. There's a lot more to it. Yeah. Augustine was reading the book of Romans, and it set the agenda in the 5th century for the rest of the church. Fast forward 11 centuries, Luther, an Augustinian monk, working on his lectures on Romans, notices that the text reads, "For the righteous shall live by faith." There's a period after the word faith, and it changes the whole course of the church. And it leads to the Reformation. For over 2 more centuries, John Wesley heard a reading from Luther's commentary on Romans, and his heart was strangely warmed. And it reformed the church again and led to a renewal of the Protestant church. Fast forward 2 more centuries, Karl Barth is working on the book of Romans, and it fell like a bombshell on the field of theologians. And it completely reoriented the way that we think about theology in the 20th century. So Augustine's intellectual legacy and his reflecting on Paul's book of Romans is part of this long tradition that continues to shape and profoundly form who we are as Christians. We need to take a time for people who are going to be going to choir to go and do that. So I'll invite you to stand up and to just stay where you are. If you need to go on to whatever the next thing is, please do. And then we'll come back here in like 3 or 4 minutes for a little bit of conversation and exchange. And maybe we can flesh out a little bit more about these controversies. Thanks very much.